Bear, thanks for coming on the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're here in town because of the Hunt Expo, right?
Yes. Yeah, we have a booth for Born Primitive Outdoor, so we'll be here all weekend.
That's awesome, man. We were talking about your military career before we came on here. You know, part of the thing about this podcast is we break it down into three subject matters: survival, which is survival slash preparedness, business, and then military. Like those are the three genres that I focus on because I want people to kind of get that experience by listening to your experiences. And you cover down on all three of those. I mean, you're the guy. Before we get into Born Primitive, because you started that business based on a lot of your worldly experiences and military experiences and academic experiences, I imagine. Let's start from the very beginning. Like, where did you grow up? And then what'd you do post growing up?
Midwest guy, youngest of three brothers, grew up in Indiana. So, you know, your normal kind of patriotic family. You know, we were all playing sports through high school. I was lucky enough to get recruited to play football in college. So I played football at Yale University. I was a middle linebacker, graduated there.
So you're the smart football player?
I wouldn't say that. I think maybe I slipped through the cracks. No, you know, we had an emphasis on academics growing up. So, I did good in school. And it got me a seat at the table at Yale. And then, you know, I made the most of that. I got good grades there and graduated and all that. But had a great time playing ball. Like, that's kind of – the plan was actually to enlist in the Navy out of high school. 9/11 happened when I was in eighth grade. And that was the – as soon as 9/11 happened, that was like, that this is happening, right? Because I was like, it's game on. And
yeah.
As a young eighth grader, you know what I mean?
A little early.
You're starting to get the testosterone, you know what I mean? You know how it goes. So that was the plan. But the football opportunity was evolving, and I kind of made a – drug deal with my parents. Hey, if I can go play football, I'll do four more years. And then they said, hey, if you still have that crazy dream, then do it when you graduate.
Got it.
So that's, went and did that for 4 years, graduated from Yale. And then I went and worked for Red Bull, which was really cool brand. I learned a lot about brand marketing, which, I've now used a lot of those kind of principles in Born Primitive. And then when I was 26, I realized it was now or never and decided to join the Navy. So did that whole thing. And Born Primitive was born a couple months before that, me going officer candidate school. Just out of the garage, I came up with a pair of compression shorts it was a very niche need we were filling for Olympic weightlifters.
Yeah.
I basically took an old football girdle from college, cut out the quad pad, and I had my neighbor, who was a seamstress, stitch it into the groin area of a pair of compression shorts because we were all doing Olympic lifting. And for when you do snatch, like, some guys are drilling their pubic bone on the transition portion of the lift.
Yeah.
To the point where, like, there were, like, professionals, like fracturing their pubic bones in competition. So I made a prototype just so I could wear it when I was doing heavy snatch days, like in the weight room, right?
Yeah.
And then guys were like, hey, man, like, you should market that, like, make that. And I was like, no, this is ridiculous. Like, look at this thing. And then I did research, and I was like, I'm not the only idiot that has this problem, right? So I learned about supply chain and just self-taught on that front, and then decided to take a swing. And I remember the first order, I'd order like 200 units, which to me was like wild.
Yeah.
So I ordered 200 units and then went off to officer candidate school. And then, I was married at the time. Mallory's our co-founder. She was full-time dental hygienist, so she had to kind of run things, but I was able to get my phone at officer candidate school, because if you become the class leader, I was told by the previous class, the only way to get your phone is if you're the class leader. So on the first day, they say, who wants to be class leader? And you get like a 30-second speech to the class. I think there was like 60 in our company or whatever. So I don't remember what I said, but fortunately they voted
He's
me.
He's the guy.
And I didn't want to actually leave the class. I just wanted to keep my head down and get done with this.
And get your cell phone.
Yeah, just get it. But I was like, if it gets my cell phone. So every night back at the barracks, we should have been shining our boots and doing all that stuff. I'd be on the phone, with one bar of service trying to do business calls and emailing my suppliers for the next order and all that. So even from the very beginning, it was very scrappy. For the first 6 years, it was just Mallory and I out of the house, took over the whole house. There's boxes everywhere, running to the post office. You know what I mean? And
grind.
We bootstrapped the whole thing. We didn't raise money. We still haven't raised money.
Yeah.
Honestly, something I'm really proud of, because a lot of the brands we compete with now have raised millions and millions.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them north of 100 million, right? And we just bootstrapped the whole thing, and we're just scrappy as hell. We've been able to kind of hang with the big dogs. That's the quick down and dirty, man. Yeah. Did 8 years in the service. And then these last 2 years have been full-time Born Primitive, just trying to take this thing to the moon. So,
yeah, I'm interested in, when you did your military time, you became an officer, and pass for officer, like good friends of mine, Andy Stumpf, who was an enlisted guy and kind of crossed over. Did you regret becoming an officer at some point?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I got some bad guidance. I equated it to like how I envisioned it being on the football field. Like I thought I would be kind of the middle linebacker of the defense, right? So in football, like, you know, if they run in motion and we got to change the coverage, a lot of times like the strong safety and the middle linebacker are helping like make that call in real time right before they snap it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the line stunts up front with the D line. Like you're there's a middle linebacker, you're very involved in a lot of that, right? And I was always, you know, I was the football captain in high school. Like I was always kind of in a leadership position. So to me, it was like, oh, I should continue being in that position because that's what's natural for me. But I didn't realize, you know, in our line of work, like that's the platoon chief is what I thought I would be doing. Like that's what, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not the OIC, not the platoon commander. Yeah. But it was still fun, man. Like it was still a really cool, opportunity. But yes, I quickly realized when I got into the job that I want to actually be doing the job. I don't want to be doing like, you know, I don't want to be making calls on a radio and like making nice PowerPoint slides. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Which is mostly the job of an officer nowadays.
Yeah, exactly. So I definitely regretted that, but still like it was an incredible opportunity and, you know, I made so many good friends and great teammates and I got, you know, you're just, you know this, you're around such type A guys that are just so unique and from so many different walks of life.
Yeah, but super intelligent.
There's this common thread and you're just, it's so hard to find that community. So I definitely miss that a lot, but it was a really cool experience.
Yeah, you in your time with the SEALs were able to see a lot of different things, especially, you know, even the Army procures a lot of its equipment from the Navy. I mean, the Navy is producing and developing a lot of the equipment that even the Army uses, and it's facilitated through Crane, and there's a whole acquisition process. But a lot of the stuff, even like the SOP mod kits that we were using back in the day, were designed by the Navy. And through the acquisition process, you had a lot of equipment, especially in clothing, that you were able to see what worked and what didn't work. Did you have any epiphanies from that? Were you like, oh crap, there's a requirement here because this stuff sucks?
Yes. So at the time, you know, when you get that first gear issue and you check into your, you know, the platoon or whatever, you think it's like Christmas. You
go so sexy.
You go down to supply and you got like all these knives they're giving free. You. And like, you're like, this is free. You know, you put it in your cage and you're like, you're going through it all. And it is cool, obviously. But I quickly realized, you know, the gear we were getting issued, a lot of it I thought was subpar. And at the time, you know, we were heavy into fitness apparel. So that's how, you know, Born Primitive in the early days, it was those shorts I talked about, but then we got into leggings and sports bras and on the men's side, like performance fitness apparel. So I was still in the fitness apparel lane, but in the back of my mind, I was like, all right, eventually I'm going to fix this because I know apparel and I am now the end user for this gear. And I think if I can combine the two, you know, being an end user, kind of knowing what the need is and having a background and being able to design apparel, it planted that seed. You know, and that, so we got kind of our outdoor layering system, which I'm sure you got a similar one. I think it was the Patagonia one. And I just thought there were a lot of discrepancies in the gear. And it also didn't sit right with me. The more I learned about some of the brands we were getting gear from, that they didn't actually support what we were doing, right? They were trying to keep an arm's distance length, but they were happy to take the SOCOM contracts, right? So to me, once I learned more about that, I was like, wait, we got a bunch of like Patriots hitters wearing all these brands and they don't actually like behind closed doors, like they don't like us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that was like another reason, hey, the gear wasn't what I thought it should be and the kind of some of the politics behind it. And so that planted the seed. Now I didn't have the bandwidth to execute on that until I got out, you know, at the 8 year mark. But that was definitely in the early days. I was like, eventually I'm going to fix this.
Interesting.
And then, you know, with the op camis, I felt like there was too much emphasis on like these heavy nylon fabrics that hold a ton of water and cotton blends. And I was like, why are we not using more high speed fabrics? So, cause to me, like mobility was the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Like if you're climbing a 50-foot caving ladder up a ship, or you got to jump a wall into it, you know, or you're running, sprinting with a belt fed through the woods and you got to jump over a log. Like we need shit that like, we need it to be made for athletes.
Interesting. Yeah.
The fit wasn't for athletes and the fabrics and the mobility was horrible. So I was shocked. It's like, we're running around in this shit. You know what I mean? And so I was like, all right, we're going to redesign op camis. We're going to get obviously all the guys' feedback, but we're going to do it in a way that when you put it on, you're like, oh damn, I can move in this, right? It's lightweight. Hey, if it gets wet, or if we're sweating, you know, if we're in the ocean or we're sweating our balls off, it's going to dry out quick. You've probably worn the nylon cotton heavy op camis, and it's like, once it's wet, it's like wet forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're wet all day now.
Yeah.
And it like doubles in weight. You know what I mean? So those were just kind of seeds that were planted to say, I know we can fix this and make it better. And, you know, finally came to fruition. We just launched Born Primitive Tactical in October with our, like, you know, our high speed op camis that are killing now, and bunch of dudes, you know, are wearing it, and the feedback's been insane. So it only took me 10 years, but we finally did.
That's what it takes, man. Business wise. I remember when we were doing we were working with Task Force. So it was DevGrew, the unit, us at the SIF company, and then Ranger Regiment and 22 SAS. And at the time, we were able to wear whatever we wanted. And I was wearing, I think it was either Australian or New Zealand, some offshoot pajama that was really lightweight. It felt like pajamas. You could see the whole situation. Like, it was literally like silk bottoms. And you're like, oh, I could see everything. But it was, I remember, because at the time I was a sniper and I was doing a lot of building climbing. And a conventional ACU, or even at the time, Cry multicam uniform, it was Cordura. I mean, it was just like really thick material, and it wouldn't allow us to climb like a climber would climb.
Yeah.
And you were just restricted by the clothes, and we were constantly blowing out crotches because of the lack of that mobility, and it would stress at the seams. And then we adopted this, also, I think it's, I'll look it up, I think it's Australian. It's really thin, really flexible. And it was like a game changer. And I was like, dude, this is the most comfortable stuff I've ever worn. And for very specific, deliberate operations, it was perfect. Likely not the greatest thing to wear long-term in the field for extended periods of time, but for doing the hit, flying the helo, doing it and coming out, it was perfect. But we didn't have that ability to change those uniforms because, you know, the R&D process at a minimum 2 years in special operations was very difficult to navigate.
Yeah, I felt the same thing. I remember there were some Air Force guys that were rolling with us, and they had some Gucci shit that they got, and we were like, what is that? You know, Air Force guys, they get all the money, all the nice stuff.
They get everything.
We were working like drug deal trades with these guys to try to get their pants. And then I remember I got one of the PJs, like I swapped pants with them, and I was like, all right, we need to make something more like this.
Yeah.
Because man, you can move in these things, and then they dry quick, especially you get wet. You know what I mean? Like, that's so critical.
Yeah.
We were getting wet a lot. So
yeah, I feel like, you know, the cool thing about a civilian business is you're not really stagnated and constrained by a limitation on how you develop. You develop at the pace of your speed. And if you're developing this up-and-coming stuff for a civilian market, the military is kind of always behind. But if you're a leap or bound ahead, they could quickly adopt that. You know, even in a two-year cycle, it's like, man, that stuff's very different. I've seen guys like Kyle Morgan wear your stuff, and I'm like, oh, that stuff, people are paying attention to it. And the adopters, the early adopters who talk about it, it's not hard for that stuff to spread like wildfire. Like, if it works, it works. And then people tell each other it works. I know this from businesses. Apparel as a business is one of the most difficult businesses in the world because it's capital intensive. You need a lot of inventory, the R&D cycles. It's just a disaster. Like, we have apparel that are mostly private labeled and partnered, but mostly deal in products and training. How were you able to manage this from a business perspective? And did your experiences in the Navy, maybe in logistics, or even at Yale facilitate this, or just this day at a time?
Just on the job training, man, and making a lot of mistakes. We just winged it. We had no clue what we were doing in the beginning. You know, we definitely still aren't perfect, but we've perfected it quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And it is a bit of a nightmare with the SKUs, man. I mean, now we're doing pants. So these op cam, the assault pant we launched, it's like we have like, I think, 7 colors now. We have a 30-inch length, a 33, you know, which is like our regular, and then a 36 inseam length, right?
Yeah.
So you got short, regular, and long, like, you know, we would get issued. And then you got waist 28 up to like a 46, right? Mm. And now you got, what, 7 colorways? So do the math on just the pants, right? Like, of keeping those SKUs stocked.
Yeah.
And then you'll get a random order where a unit needs a bunch of OD greens and you didn't forecast for that. So now you're wiped out and you got to wait 3-4 months to get restocked. So we're still figuring that out. So, But, you know, we have, you know, on the fitness side, I mean, we have thousands and thousands of SKUs. And so, yeah, it's been a lot to manage. And just kind of little, you know, over time, you figure it out. We made some major mistakes over the years. During COVID, the supply chain got crazy. So to try to guess on demand when demand was going through the roof, but also lead times like doubled, like how do you forecast 7 months out? Like if I place this order now and I'm going to receive it in 7 months, how do you guess? You know what I mean? When you're exponential, right? So you put this huge order in and just hope for the best.
Yeah. Typically cash or a line of credit that's
Then it gets really complicated, because you got to manage your cash flow, right? So if you have to wire, you know, millions of dollars and you're waiting on product, you know what I mean? And then let's say it doesn't move, you know, so it is this giant calculation of you know, it's a bit of cat and mouse game and a bit of intuition. Mm-hmm. And then you can rely on data, of course, too, based on like sale velocity. But a lot of times like that only takes you so far. Like you got to kind of have gut instinct. Like if we're ordering all the op cams, it's like, all right, what colors do we think are going to hit? And we kind of debate it and like, all right, let's slide our chips in on those three. We'll stock the other four, but like those are going to be the lead sled dogs. You know what I mean? So it's tough, man. I was actually out at SHOT Show a few weeks ago and I ran into one of the guys that was early on in founding Beyond. And he's now out of that business. And we had had a few drinks and he was like, I don't know how you do it, man. Like, thank God I'm out of that game.
I remember that company Beyond.
Like, I don't know any better. I was like, this is just what we did. And, you know, it all started with just a pair of compression shorts. So there was no vision at all. We were just going for it. Yeah.
Hey, guys, this podcast is brought to you by the U.S. Concealed Carry Association. You know we're big fans of survival, and survival always depends on one question. How prepared are you? Just like we work to be prepared to survive any situation, the USCCA trains you to be prepared and feel confident as a gun owner, especially if you ever need to use it in self-defense. I've been a member for over 3 years because not only do I get access to their online Protector Academy, where I can learn from experts on critical aspects of survival, such as how to shoot accurately under pressure and how to prepare for family and home defense planning, but I also get self-defense liability insurance in case I'm ever involved in a dangerous incident. There's a reason 800,000 American gun owners like myself trust them. So check them out at uscca.com/FCS to claim your risk-free benefits right now, as well as a free gift when you sign up. That's uscca.com/FCS. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, you could be one misstep away from completely destroying the business. You know, it's not like any other businesses where you could land on predictable measures. When you look at supply chain and you invest all that capital, if something goes wrong along the way, direct to the consumer, it could be like this stitch isn't right, and then it all fails.
Totally.
You have to recycle the entire thing, and there's not a lot of contingency plans that you could build into that.
Yeah, that's huge risk. So if there's ever a new supplier, like you, that's a major danger because like our suppliers we've been working with for 8 or 9 years, if they mess something up, like they know, like, cause I'm giving them so much business, like they have to replace it, right?
Yeah.
Because we're not gonna sell that to the customer, right? And that's happened a few times, and obviously the customer doesn't see it cause if, you know, even if it's thousands of units, they'll say, hey, ship us another batch, like I'm not selling this. And they're like, because the business is so strong, they know, all right, it's worth us to keep their business. But I remember during COVID, man, we had brought in a new girl for help with inventory management, and I was deployed. Mal was doing her best to run the business. We're in explosive growth because of COVID, right? And this girl was not on purpose, but she was trying to use this software and she just wasn't experienced like she should have been. And that's our fault for not hiring the right person. And she was just doing her best. But I'm on deployment running around. Mal's like doing a million things trying to manage the business. So she would submit these purchase orders to Mal, and Mal would see it and be like, yeah, sounds good. Like send it. And I eventually got back from deployment. I looked at some of the purchase orders. I remember like one time we like ordered like 30,000 units of like a maroon women's jogger, like in one color, like 30,000 units. And I was like, how many did we sell in all of that last year? And it was like, you know, a fraction of that. I'm like, wait a second, what the hell? You know what I mean? And we got to the point where we were so over indexed on inventory that like I had to loan a bunch of money to the business to like, now the business was killing. So like, you know what I mean? We were, you know, technically profitable because you can't write off your goods until you sell it.
Yeah.
But we were so over leveraged on a cash standpoint, like me and Mal and like my brothers, we had to like put like over $1 million back into the business just to like stay alive.
Crazy.
And that was the year we literally made, you know, it was our best year ever.
Yeah.
Right. So you're right. I mean, one little miss, and thank God I caught it. You know what I mean? Because You know, then I pulled a few layers back and I was like, wait a second, like this is insanity. Like, did we add a zero? Like, should that have been, you know, 3,000, not 30,000 or so. There are major pitfalls and, you know, we've been able to mostly avoid those, but that's how, you know, sometimes the best way to learn is the hard way, like that.
Yeah.
No, because now I know, okay, that's a major blind spot and that can kill you.
What's Born Primitive is one of the best names for a clothing company I've ever heard. I've heard about your guys' stuff. And like before I even linked up with you and we started talking about doing a podcast, and was really impressed by all the things you guys do. You guys do marketing really well. You guys obviously have a good reputation in the clothing space already from people who are users. What's Born Primitive's mission when it comes to all the things that you guys are touching? Because, you know, I touched some of your pants that you brought in and was like, man, this is not just for the operator, this is for the overlander, this is for the tactical guy, this is for the moto guy. And so do you have a mission statement that you specifically have a goal of achieving in your vision?
Well, I think it all comes down to just active lifestyle, you know what I mean? And I think it's for us, it's all rooted at its core in the gym. That's where it was born, right? And you know, it honestly, selfishly, it just became, for at least for the men's side, I wanted to have clothes for everything I did in my life, right? So it was like, we started with fitness stuff, and then it was like, we got into like athleisure apparel, and then this, like, I'm wearing our, you know, our flannel, like we call it our campfire collection. It's jeans and denim jackets and flannels, you know what I mean? Like and then we have an active professional line. So it's like, we got like stretchy dress pants and like nice stretchy button-up shirts that like look good, you know what I mean? And breathe. So every little component of my life, I'd be like, oh, well, let's design a little thing for that. It's like, you know, I kind of mirrored my active lifestyle, and then, you know, fit and function was just massive. Like, I just thought there were so many brands that were missing the fit and the mobility component. So most of our stuff stretches, and it's such a simple thing. It's like, just make everything stretch and you're fine.
Why would you not do that?
I'm never going to wear a dress shirt ever again that doesn't stretch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And same with my dress pants. Like, when I sit down, I can't like blow out the ass seam because I'm doing, you know, squats. I'm on a squat cycle or something. So I think from the product standpoint, that's really how these new spinoffs created, you know, for Born Primitive Outdoor, which we launched last year, that, you know, that's extended field stay layering system that, you know, we got trained on, you know, and we got issued. I was like, I think we can make this better. And I think from my optics, some of the brands that were making that gear were too far removed from the shooter level wearing it. You know what I mean? Like, even the big brands that you thought are very credible in those spaces, I was like, I think the guys designing this probably haven't worn kit in 10 years. You know what I mean? And I was like, so good attempt, but there's little nuances. If you're actually the guy wearing it, you're like, they missed this. Like, they didn't think of this, or they didn't think that this zipper is going to flap and free fall and slap you in the face. And like, you know what I mean? These little things where you're like, had they tested this with a guy actually doing it for a living, they wouldn't have done that. So I saw opportunity there. And I think just from a brand positioning standpoint, you know, we've always positioned ourselves as a brand that, like, one, we're never going to apologize for loving our country. You know, we're always going to support the flag. I saw an opportunity when I looked at brands across all spectrums. I saw very few brands were relating to just a patriotic kid from the Midwest like me and the dudes that were doing the job, and, you know what I mean, our police and first responders, and, you know what I mean? I just thought, man, they're really missing it here. There's a large, you know, cohort of our population that, you know, is all about that and loves our country. So that was one thing I never wanted to waver on. So from the very, very beginning, we've been unapologetically patriotic. And, you know, I think from the other part of the mentality of the brand is the way I was raised, and it kind of, you know, influenced the brand personality, was like the victim mentality that's being like pushed in our society. Like, we wanted to cut against the grain on that completely and just reject it and say, hey, you only get what you earn. You know what I mean? You got to go out and get it. So we've definitely always had a little bit of an edge, and that was on purpose. And I think it's much needed right now in our current, especially in our current society. And I think that's why we've been successful, because I think guys like the products, girls like the products, but more importantly, they're like, hey, I can relate to the ethos of that company.
Yeah.
And we didn't, it wasn't just a punchline, you know, we actually, you know, over half of our employees are former, you know, our veterans, former first responders and the spouses of those, you know, we donate a good amount of money to veteran charities and things like that. So we try to back it with like, well, what are we actually doing about it?
Yeah.
It's not just some company slogan, you know what I mean? Like, we're living it, you know? So kind of went long on that, but,
It seems like the message of all the things that you're doing is based off of you. I mean, a lot of what you have experienced and what you do, and that's awesome because you need a messenger, you need a leader to kind of run that entire thing. Like, I look at things like Kool, you know, Made in the Mountains, and they're a great company. I mean, Kevin and the guys who started Kool in our backyard, none of this shit fits me. I mean, it's just so tight and just, it's, I'm constrained. And yeah, it looks good and functions decent in Garrison, but it's not like the stuff we need for doing the activities that we do. I mean, for like the pants that I saw with the reinforcement on the back of the ass and the back of the legs, like people miss that all the time. Like I've blown my big ass. You're the same size. Yeah. Our big asses cannot wear conventional clothing because we will blow out seams, blow out. And then that's from being an active, larger person. And there's not a company that's making equipment for those type of people, which is crazy because you would think the guys who are putting out this equipment are actually going out and doing that. And most of these companies don't find out until the feedback. And they're like, dude, like my Kool button, every time I go out on all my Kool pants, the button blows out the top. And I've looked it up online. It's like a big issue. But most of the issue is because I fluctuate 10 pounds depending on what I eat that day and water weight. But again, like why would you not put elasticity so you could address some of those issues? I'm interested in your take on material, because a lot of the material we used in the global war on terror and military issued stuff is mil spec. And I almost feel like that's like direct line to 500 denier, like 1000 Cordura. But you've got a lot of creative ways on how you look at material and textiles and integrate it into clothing. Like, what's your philosophy on that? And kind of what are some of the things that you guys are doing different that you could talk about that's different from everybody else?
Well, I think that when we select the fabrics, I know I'm beating a dead horse, but there has to be a mobility component to it. And that's like the number one thing we look at.
Like movement, physical movement of your body. Like
if I have to climb a ladder or I need to sprint or jump over something, or whatever, like I feel like guys in our line of work should be treated like athletes. Mm. Like, you know what I mean? Like you wouldn't give a football player like a pair of football pants that don't stretch.
Yeah.
You'd be like, oh, hey, wear these nylon pants out on the football field. You'd be like, that makes no sense.
Yeah, interesting.
So we needed to apply the same principle because we're moving just as much as those guys are. Right.
Yeah.
And so like, to me, it was such an obvious thing. Like why isn't everyone doing this? Mm. Are they talking to any of the end users? Like, you know, and so the fabrics, you know, we go nuts on fabric selection. Like it's a little bit overwhelming in the beginning. We kind of narrow it down, but the cool thing is like, we have a massive advantage because in Virginia Beach, we have a lot of guys that are still able to test it. And even the guys that work for me, you know, that were in the line of work, like, you know, our guy Bruno, who runs Bornproof Tactical for us, and he was a former 160th and former SF guy and just an absolute stud. He did 41 years.
Wow.
He would take the op pants and go do like an OTB, like on the beach. And he'd come back with this report, you know what I mean? And he would wear them to the gym and he was dropping, you know, even like the developing the knee pad insert. We were like, all right, let's get like five different thicknesses. And then Bruno would wear all the different thicknesses and drop to a knee on like a rock and then put the other one in and then drop it. Because we wanted, all right, how minimal can we make this to still protect like we need to?
Yeah.
And even pockets, like they of course all needed to be able to drain out, right? So when you come out of the water in the beach, like you don't have the big pocket full of water, which, you know, every little nuanced thing was thought through. So the fabrics had to kind of align with that mission. So a lot of the fabrics, like, all right, if we're going to be in the water and come out of the water, it can't be dry. It has to dry fast. We want it to be lightweight. But it needs to be durable enough. Right. So there's a lot of super lightweight fabrics that we experimented with. We're like, all right, yes, these feel freaking awesome. Mm-hmm. Like if you come down a wall or something, like they're going to rip. So like there's a balance, right? Mm. I don't need this heavy nylon stuff that, like, you know, is going to be totally bombproof because I'd sacrifice a lot of mobility. Find that middle ground material that's durable enough, but is way better in allowing the person to move in it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we narrow it down. And then, you know, we've got into like, we've learned that you can like silver treat the fabrics now. So like it's this crazy antimicrobial property. So they do this silver mist on everything, like little things like that.
Yeah.
Because like over time guys are like, hey, I've wore this for 2 years. It's starting to stink. And we're like, oh, check. So we'd go back to the drawing board and, okay, we found this new technology. So it costs us a lot more, but it's like, hey, if I want this guy to be able to wear this under kit. Or if you're out on a hunt for 8 days and it's your base layer, you know what I mean? Like, you know how that goes. Like, you know, you start stinking real bad. But yeah. if you got a nice merino wool that's been treated with this thing, it's like, yeah, that actually makes a massive difference.
Yeah.
So we just try to be really meticulous, man. And we make sure, like, hey, if we're putting our name on this thing, like, that's our reputation. And the way I see it is, like, if a new customer buys our stuff for the first time, that is probably my only shot at convincing them that we make a good product. And if any of the products they get are subpar, like, you're probably never getting them again.
Yeah.
And as competitive as the space is, like, you just can't afford to miss that.
Yeah.
Particularly because we didn't raise a bunch of capital, right? So I'm not able to spend $30 million on Facebook ads. And it's like, oh, well, that batch was bad. Like, we'll just put another $10 million into Facebook and, like, we'll acquire another 100,000 customers. You know what I mean? We our margin of error isn't big enough to do that. So, like, in the development phase, we got to nail it. So,
yeah, you, I imagine right now most of your sales are direct to consumer online.
Yes.
Do you do any retail?
Yeah, we're starting to dabble in that. So we're in the Navy exchanges, and then we have some retail accounts. But yeah, Navy exchange has been going really well, and we just brought on a director of retail sales. He's been in the game like 25 years. So I'm turning him loose on going after the big box retail.
And it's a huge step.
He sees massive opportunity. You know, he looked at our brand and he was like, man, like, they need this because, like, the brands that are boring now, like, they're going to love the fact that you guys have edge and you stand for what you believe in.
Yeah.
So he thinks there's a high probability that, you know, we're going to get some really good traction there. So that's kind of the next phase of this. That brings a whole new onslaught of risk and cash flow considerations, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you could get a $20 million purchase order from someone, but it's like, all right, now I got to wire millions to fund it. Mm-hmm. And if they're on net 90 terms or something, and then sometimes I'm hearing, like, they don't even pay, like, these retailers just won't pay.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll just, like, yeah, it's been 6 months and they're like, I will pay you when you pay you, because they know they kind of have the leverage.
Oh yeah.
So it's a whole nother game that we'll have to, of course, navigate. And he's been in the game, so I'm going to rely on him to kind of illuminate the blind spots. But I think it's time. We're 10 years in. I think we're ready.
Yeah, that's a huge step, man. Congratulations on that. I know big box retail is something that I didn't really understand until we started dabbling, and then all the constraints it creates, and, you know, back cash inventory, flow management, like, all these things. You're like, oh, so getting a $10 million PO is a problem.
Yeah.
It's a huge problem. It's a good problem to have.
Good problem to have.
But it's a big problem.
But dangerous.
Dangerous. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Outside the apparel, what's your marketing strategy for something like Born Primitive? Because, you know, like, you're at the hunting expo right now, and I could see this as a hunter pant, but you have to integrate with camo, you got to do all these things, and there's dilemmas in that market. Just like if you went into Overland West and Overland Expo, there's dilemmas in that market. How are you positioning the company and telling the story? Like, what is the strategy there on something so comprehensive, it seems?
Well, I think in any kind of vertical you enter into, you have to be really credible, right? Like, you can't just come into the space and, like, okay, we're in hunting now. It's like, all right, you know, are you a part of this community? Same thing with tactical. Like, that one was an easy one, because that was our roots. You know, so for the outdoor one, you know, we partnered up with Aaron Snyder.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously he has huge credibility in kind of that Western hunting
space. He's the man.
Yeah. And basically I went to him and I got linked up through a mutual friend, and I said, hey man, I introduced myself and I said, I know enough about layering systems to be dangerous. I also know how to design apparel and find the Gucci fabrics, but, like, you're the dude in the field now, 250 days out of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I need you to, you know, kind of provide that last 20% to fine tune these products.
Mm.
So, like, we're going to work together on this, but ultimately, like, your name is going to be on this and mine. So, like, and that's how it all started. So right. That's just one example of, like, you know, we try to enter a space with credibility, and we obviously leveraged Aaron's credibility in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
but now we're in it. Right. So we're going out on hunts and, you know, we're at the expos and, you know, we're trying to be a part of it, not just trying to serve, like, Facebook ads to people on their newsfeed and hope, like, oh, we're a hunting brand now. Like, and that's in the early days, we were a CrossFit brand, and we were born in the CrossFit gym, but, like, we were credible because I was competing. Like, I would go do, like, my heat and come back to the booth with chalk all over me, all sweaty, and I'd be trying to sell, like, sports bras. You know what I mean? So it's like, oh, this makes sense. Like, this dude's a part of our, you know, it's endemic to the community. So that credibility naturally happened, where I see a lot of other brands, they'll try to, like, pivot to a space and they just throw money at it. And they just think, all right, if we sign all the big athletes and we just crush their newsfeed on Facebook, and, you know what I mean, we sponsor all the big, like, the title sponsorships, like, we'll be accepted. And a lot of times it doesn't work like that, because in those kind of tight-knit communities, you can sniff that out pretty easily. Mm. So I think regardless of where you're going, you have to do it, you know, the right way, in a way that like, they're like, oh, right on. Like, they are one of us. Like, yeah, it makes sense. You know what I mean? And yeah, for us to go into outdoor, like, it did make sense. Tactical, it totally made sense. And so that's kind of how it's evolved.
How do you guys, do you project like your 3, 5, 10 year plan? What's the whole plan with a apparel company like Born Primitive? I mean, some businesses are made to sell, right? People, yeah, create these business plans, and it's to eventually get an acquisition.
Yeah.
What is you guys' plan? Because it seems like you enjoy what you do. Obviously, you wouldn't be in the grind if you didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had been really stubborn to private equity money throughout the entire kind of life of the company, because I saw a lot of brands we competed with were raising, you know, millions, and you would see the brand change almost immediately.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's no way I'm going to let, yeah, some dude in a suit in San Francisco and New York, like, running my company.
Yeah.
Right. Like, Born Primitive needs to be true to who we are. Like, we're never going to change. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, like, we will lose everything we have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I was always kind of very vocal about that, and maybe probably to a fault. But I'm now to the point where, like, all right, I realize there are good partners you can find that still align with your values, mm-hmm, and can allow you to maintain the kind of the authenticity that you have. Now, you got to be careful who you get in bed with, of course.
And that's
something we'll vet out.
Yeah.
I also realized, honestly, just on a personal level, that most of my net worth as a human was tied up in this giant thing I'd been building for 10 years, right? And it was like, all right, for the sake of my family and kind of just, I would like to take a few chips off the table, right? So this all isn't for nothing if something catastrophic happens. So right now we're on a roadmap. I'm calling it a 2 to 3 year window. We are optimizing the business to take on a major investor. You know, so that's why we're getting into retail. Like, that'll look huge. We're obviously diversifying the brand into outdoor and tactical. We're diversifying our supply chain. I'm basically reverse engineering, okay, what are they going to look for from like a risk standpoint? Like, where is the risk to invest in Born Primitive? I'm trying to get ahead of all of those. Because we were in the process, and we had a very good opportunity. The banks shut, you know, Silicon Valley Bank. We were under an LOI, so we have 60 days to close the deal. They get to do all their due diligence. Everything was going great. You know, everyone was high-fiving. We thought we'd close in March. This was now January. Silicon Valley Bank went down, and then like a few other banks went down. So then the debt market went to shit, right? And
yeah,
then everyone started getting skittish. So long story short, that deal fell through. So I went through an entire year process thinking we were going to close, and it fell through last minute. But I learned a ton. Now I know what they look for, and I was like, check, we're going to do this again, and next time we're going to be even more ready. You know what I mean? So that's
and bigger.
And bigger. And we're going to be way more investable, because we're like, hey, before we didn't have tactical, we didn't have outdoor. You know, we also have a shoe. Performance, it's called the Savage One, which is killing. You know, we have a podcast now, like, we have some intellectual property kind of stuff that's been going really well. So the goal is, when we go back to the table, particularly if retail's ripping and we're selling to the government now, you know,
yeah,
Berry compliant, made in the USA stuff, now it's going to get real interesting. And I hope it's just an absolute war. People want to, you know, come to work with us.
Yeah. I think when people don't understand about business in scale, especially when you're leaping and bounding in scale, you're evolving to mega companies. There is, like, it's not selling out by taking on capital and building and evolving, because there are a lot of partnered opportunities with larger companies that allow your brand to have more brand equity, more social equity,
yeah,
and influencing and getting your product out there. Like, I tell people, if you go to Walmart or if you go to Bass Pro and you buy something off the shelf, most of the time, especially in big box retail, you're doing it because of the position it is in the store. You go, oh, this looks nice.
Yeah.
Right. And you don't go, who's the owner of this place?
Yeah.
I wonder if he's got a good reputation. So if you have both positions, because you're maintaining your integrity, you're building a brand through social equity, which takes a lot of blood, sweat, and tears over the years, then you never want to lose that. So even if you take on capital, keep that validity and integrity you built in the market, and then ramp it up and blow it out, because you want both options. You want the person who's shopping and then puts on the pants and goes, these are the best pants I've ever worn. Who are these people? And then they're become more vested and interested versus just having one ancillary path where you're like, hey guys, our new drop drops this Friday. If you're paying attention, then potentially you could buy some. If you're not, sorry, we can't touch you. And so I think there's a benefit of both, because I think, like, you know, I look at your company, I think about Origin, I know Pete, I know Jocko. It's like, man, there's something there. I don't know what it is, but it's like there's potential integration as everybody evolves together. And I think that's a cool thing is, you know, even in the military experience, you kind of recognize that where it's not just your way in a unilateral vertical that's going to crush it. It's the partnerships. It's the investments. Like Aaron Snyder's perfect because he's the guy, he's the man.
That's right.
If you ask me, who is the guy who's doing it for real? I mean, I feel like he should be sitting at his desk more. I talk to Aaron all the time, but he's backcountry hunting because that's why Kafaro bags are some of the best bags in the world because they ops test it constantly through his experiences. And that's a good testament to what you guys are doing, man. I love it, man. Shoes.
Yeah.
So talk to me about these shoes.
Yeah. So it's kind of same thing, man. When I was active duty, I was like, I eventually want to do shoes. Cause honestly, like as an apparel company, you can make the argument you're not truly legitimate until you have footwear. Like, you know what I mean? Like you're kind of JV. As soon as you're in footwear, like you're
all of them have it. Solomon, all these guys have all of them.
And I really liked the early Reebok Nanos and I liked the early Nike Metcons. I thought it was a great shoe and obviously that's what I wore.
It's a cross trainer, right?
You know, it's kind of a CrossFit shoe. And unfortunately, over the years, I felt as the kind of customer that they were over-engineering it. It was getting bulky and it just wasn't the shoe it was back in the day. And I was like, I know I could do this better, right? But I had no knowledge in footwear. Like I didn't even know where to start. Ironically, there was another officer at my team that his dad has been in the footwear game forever. And he was like, hey, dude, like, let me link you up with my dad, which was like, I literally passed him in like the hallway and at the team. And I was like, yeah, sure. So like we linked up on an email and I realized they had done all this development for a bunch of big shoe brands. Mm. And I kind of, you know, we did a kickoff call and I quickly realized that these guys were real players and they help us bring the vision of the Savage One to life. Mm. It's just a cross training shoe.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be versatile enough that you don't need to be changing shoes at the gym. Like, all right, I'm doing squats now. I got to put these shoes on. And then I'm doing a Metcon. So I got to switch out to these shoes and I'm running 400s, box jumps, whatever. I'm like, all right, put one pair of shoes on and you're freaking good. Mm. So that's kind of how we designed it. Very long process. We went through like 5 or 6 prototypes. It was a little bit overwhelming because you don't even know where to start, right? But once again, I was like, I told the team, we have one shot at this. If the Savage One doesn't rip, there will be no Savage Two.
Yep.
Right? Like it's just not gonna happen. Yep. So like I don't care if we have to wait another year. Like there's no timeline on this. There's no gun to the head. Like we have to launch by July. We will do as many prototypes and samples as we need to until we're like, hell yeah, we'll put our logo on that. Like this is gonna kill. Mm. And that's what we did. So that's why it took over 2 years. Mm. We finally launched it last June. We sold out in a day. And now that's a whole nother problem because shoe lead times are like 5 to 6 months mm-hmm. and minimum order quantities are like, 10,000 units. Mm. Right. So it's a whole new problem set that you now have to learn about because it's a different game. Mm. So how do you forecast supply and demand when you have to wait 6 months and your minimums are pretty big? You know what I mean? So that first order was a little risky. Cause I was like, what if the shoe sucks? And like, or what if there's a major quality control issue? You know what I mean? Like you're not getting that back, but that's, why we were very methodical in the design because I was like, we can't afford that to happen.
Yeah.
And if you got $10 million in the bank from the private equity firm that cut you a check, you have a little bit of a cushion, right? But when you're using cash to fund the next purchase order all the time, like that, you really don't have that kind of safety net. So yeah, it's just gotta be, just like anything, man, you plan it out and then you gotta shoot your shot. So that's what we did.
Your business gives me anxiety.
Oh, dude. Yeah.
It's rough, man. We did it and it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's cool because I see an opportunity in some of the designs. Again, getting back to the kind of the patriotic values, like we're gonna launch our Don't Tread on Me shoe this year.
Sweet.
We're launching the Betsy Ross Savage One next year. And we're doing a D-Day 80th anniversary D-Day shoe. So it's got a Band of Brothers vibe.
I'm jumping into D-Day with Andy, Evan. We'll wear those shoes.
I think I'll be there.
Are you gonna jump in with us?
I mean, shit, if I can. So the Best Defense Foundation is a charity that takes World War II veterans back to their
battlefields. That's right.
Donnie Edwards found it. He's a good friend of
mine.
That's
right. Yeah.
So we're doing this shoe in collaboration with them. We're going to donate a bunch of money from the sales to their organization. But it's badass. It says 6/6/1944 on the back, 0/6/30, Operation Overlord. It's OD green. It's greens and it just looks badass. We're gonna sell 500 limited edition ones. It's gonna come in a big ammo can.
Yeah.
And then the wood crate, that you gotta break out with a multi-tool to break it open. And then we're getting sand from Omaha Beach. So the Prime Minister gave us permission to bring sand back So every person will get a vial of sand and then a commemorative like challenge coin for just that shoe.
It comes out June 6th?
You will. That's when we're going to pre-order in June.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we can't. It won't come until August.
Yeah.
So we just missed the window barely.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. And then you're going to get a baseball card with like the different veterans that'll be on the trip, so you can see like, oh, this guy like jumped into D-Day. And it's so cool because the donations to that organization directly fund these guys to go back. So like some of these guys. Because I went to the Pearl Harbor one, and it was epic.
Jack Carr was there too.
Jack, yeah, that's right. Where I met Jack. Became good friends with Jack. But you know, some of these guys, you know, did you know they were 18 years old? You know, when they stormed, you know, like Omaha and
Babies.
You know, Beach, and they haven't been back since. So they take these guys back, and they have like historians next to them, and say, "Hey, this is where your unit like flanked up." To, you know what I mean? And they have the maps and stuff, and then it comes back to them, and then they go to the cemetery. Some of these guys, you know, never saw their buddies buried. So they're going to their buddy's grave for the first time ever. And they're 100 years old. It's freaking wild.
Man, you'll be there, right?
I'm hoping so. Yeah. I'm working with Donnie. So the shoe is meant to kind of commemorate the 80th and raise a ton of money for charity. And it's just a badass shoe. Like even as a standalone without the D-Day thing, it's a cool colorway. So it gives us the opportunity to kind of do cool shit like that.
Yeah.
And it's hard to kind of portray that through like, you know, a pair of shorts or, you know what I mean? But like with the shoe, you can do a little bit more detailed stuff with it. So we're really excited. My mind never shuts off with ideas like that. So who the hell knows what'll be next? And maybe, you know, Gettysburg edition shoe. I don't know. But we try to leverage it for a good cause when we can, because that's gets people even more fired up too. So,
yeah, I love it, man. You're right. When it comes to patriotic positions, there's coffee companies, there's gun companies, there's all these companies. There's certainly t-shirt companies,
yeah,
but there isn't an apparel company that's positioning that way with more conservative values and just being the company that you get aligned with. Because, I mean, I think about REI. I really like REI. I shop there a lot. But when they pull like Camelback, the bladders are there. I saw the bladders there. I actually bought one recently from there. But when they pull, they're actually stock. Because it doesn't align or it's affiliated with guns or something like that. That's disturbing to me, man.
It's crazy, man.
Yeah. And
yeah. It's to see kind of the shift in kind of the corporate culture and like what's getting pushed, jammed down all of our throats is just so nuts right now.
Yeah.
To the point where like a lot of these things, you don't know what's satire and what's real anymore. You know what I mean? It's just so out of control.
It's a tough landscape.
And I see incredible opportunity there because I think there's a lot of Americans that don't feel like they're their values are being represented in mainstream media and our politicians and stuff. So like, it's like, hey, there are actually brands who will have the balls to stand for these things. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to like whisper it behind closed doors. Like, hey guys, let's just go out and say it. We don't need to apologize for like being all about the American flag. We don't need to apologize for being proud of our country and what it stands for. And, you know, like embracing freedom and just recognizing the sacrifices that have been made to give us the life we all have right now. Mm-hmm. So can we all like stop complaining for once and just be grateful? And you know what I mean? And especially, you know, these old guys, man, and you talk to them that, you know, they're 100 years old and it's so different. And then these guys were, you know, forging birth certificates to get into the war.
Yeah.
You know what I
mean? To get in.
And you know, now people are faking some other things too. Like, I wouldn't even go there, but you know what I mean? Right. It's like, what are we doing here?
So crazy, man. What a time to be alive.
It is.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast, man. Where can people find the things that you guys are doing and learn more about the brand? You guys have YouTube and Instagram?
Yeah, we got all that. So our main site is bornprimitive.com. Everything we talked about can be found on that site. But if you want more of an outdoor or tactical site experience, the outdoor stuff is on bornprimitiveoutdoor.com. And the tactical is bornprimitivetactical.com. You can find it all there. Same thing with Instagram. You know, it's bornprimitive, bornprimiteoutdoor, tactical, etc. Yeah, so check us out. You know, we're a veteran-owned company. We're doing this about 10 years, you know, scrappy brand. We've always been the underdog. You know, we do leverage, you know, what we do to give back. So if that's important to you, you know, we're coming up on over $2 million donated to date as a company to veteran charities. So, you know, we live it. It's not a punchline. It means a lot to us. And hopefully, you know, if that fires people up and they hope, you know, like the gear, you know, that's I think an implied task, but you got to make a good product. You can't just be brand. Mm-hmm. And I think we've done a decent job doing both. So,
awesome.
That's where you can find us, man.
Thanks, Baron. Yeah. Appreciate you, man.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, bornprimitive.com, guys. And we're going to do a bonus segment after this on the app about specifically preparedness, especially textiles and like what equipment you need, and also Bear's personal ideas and philosophy on being prepared and like what he does in his everyday habits. You find that on the Philcraft Survival app. I'll link all the stuff we talked about down below, including some of the charity work. We'll put that in the description as well. Hope you guys are paying attention. Appreciate you guys. Till next time. Peace out.
We all know something's wrong, but who's gonna change?